Imagine a world where intelligent machines weren't just the stuff of, blockbuster movies or science fiction novels. Picture them serving humanity, perhaps guarding colossal fortresses, or maybe even bringing lifeless statues to vibrant animate life. For centuries, across countless ancient civilizations, these weren't just wild imaginings. No, they were foundational myths, incredible engineering marvels, albeit early ones, and enduring elements of human belief.
It's a truly universal human dream, this idea of artificial life, isn't it? What's striking is how consistent those dreams seem to have been, regardless of the culture or the era. It really highlights something deeply ingrained in us.
That consistency is absolutely fascinating. And today, we're embarking on a journey that spans millennia, really. From ancient myths whispered around campfires to the cutting-edge algorithms powering our world now. This deep dive is all about the surprising parallels between these ancient dreams of artificial life and our modern advancements in artificial intelligence. We're going to explore humanity's enduring fascination with creating intelligent beings, tracing these incredible themes across vastly different cultures and eras.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just about how modern AI might be fulfilling some of those ancient fantasies. Although that's interesting in itself, what's truly exciting, I think, is how AI is actively helping us uncover entirely new insights about history itself, literally reshaping our understanding of the past sometimes. And this raises an important question for all of us, doesn't it? How does our relationship with technology continue to echo those ancient patterns of belief and wonder? You know, blurring the lines between what's real and what's imagined.
That's precisely our mission today. For this deep dive, our sources come from a really rich collection. We've got historical reviews, deep philosophical examinations of AI paradigms, articles on AI's surprising and honestly transformative applications in archaeology, and fascinating analyses of ancient myths and automata. We'll be drawing from all these diverse perspectives to try and stitch together a comprehensive understanding of humanity's long and kind of winding journey with artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So let's unpack this. Okay, so our story begins really in the echoes of antiquity. It's genuinely mind-boggling to think that humanity's ability to imagine artificial intelligence stretches back thousands of years, long before any self-moving devices were even technologically conceivable, right? We're talking about a time when basic mechanics were still just emerging, yet the concept of animated, non-biological entities was already firmly rooted in human thought.
It really is profound. And what's key here is the concept historian Adrian Mayer highlights, biotechny. It's basically anything made, not born, whether that creation springs from divine power or, human ingenuity. This really emphasizes that these ancient stories weren't just whimsical fantasies. They were, in a way, early technological visions, sort of bold thought experiments about the nature of creation and control. They were grappling with fundamental questions about what it means to be alive, what it means to be conscious.
Right. Mayer suggests that imagination is the spirit that unites myth and science. That phrase really captures it, doesn't it? How these ancient narratives weren't just tales of gods and heroes. They often explored core ideas about what it meant to create, to animate, and crucially, to control, or perhaps not control, the things we bring into existence. They were wrestling with concepts that thousands of years later, we're still grappling with in the world of AI.
Absolutely. And if we look across these early imaginings, we see remarkably consistent themes emerging. Across vastly different cultures, different geographies, we find artificial servants designed for practical labor, formidable guardians protecting sacred spaces or valuable resources, and sentient beings created to serve either human or divine will. The functions they serve were remarkably similar, even if the methods of their creation were entirely mythical or deeply magical. This consistency really hints at a universal human desire for aid, protection, and maybe even companionship from non-biological entities.
Which brings us to some truly iconic mythical automata and artificial beings. Let's start with ancient Greece, maybe around 750 to 650 BCE onwards. Homer's Iliad gives us one of the earliest literary references. We find Hephaestus, the god of smithing, using automatic bellows in his forge. Okay, simple but still a fascinating early concept of automation. But here's where it gets really interesting. He also crafts these incredible golden handmaidens. And they're not just fancy robots. Homer describes them as being endowed with understanding, speech, strength, and cunning handiwork.
Exactly. That's the key part, understanding, speech. These were intelligent assistants, capable of complex tasks and communication, not mere mechanical devices following simple commands. It's a vision of sentient, helpful AI from the very dawn of Western literature. It's pretty stunning.
It really is. And Homer's Odyssey also describes the ships of the Phaeacians, which perfectly obey their human captains. These weren't just fast ships. they navigated autonomously, detecting threats and moving at the speed of thought, needing no helmsman.
Mm-hmm. A vision of true intelligent automation and predictive navigation, long before anything remotely like it was even dreamed of, technically. It speaks to a deep human desire for effortless, intuitive control over complex systems, doesn't it?
Definitely. And then there's Talos. If you've seen any ancient Greek mythology depicted, you probably know Talos, the giant bronze sentry, also created by Hephaestus. This formidable automaton patrolled the shores of Crete, hurling massive rocks at intruders, or get this, heating himself red hot to destroy enemies by embracing them.
A truly fearsome guardian. It's an incredibly early and potent concept of an independent, if maybe limited, form of artificial life, specifically designed for defense, a precursor to our modern security robots or autonomous defense systems in a way.
And the Greek imagination didn't stop there, did it?
Not at all. Think of Cadmus sowing dragon's teeth to sprout an army of warriors. This idea of life artificially grown from inert matter, almost like a primordial form of bioengineering, you could argue. Or Pygmalion's ivory statue, Galatea, famously brought to life by divine intervention. That embodies the artistic desire to create something so perfect it could transcend its inanimate form.
And we can't forget King Alcinous's palace, guarded by golden and silver dogs made by Hephaestus. Again, guardians. Not just decorative, they were vigilant, unceasing protectors. And Daedalus, yes, that Daedalus, the legendary craftsman, was said to have built these famously realistic moving statues that, hilariously, needed to be tethered to stop them from just wandering off.
Right. These aren't just fantastical stories. They reflect a persistent, deeply human fascination with animating the inanimate, and maybe a blend of awe and apprehension about the creations we bring forth. That tension is there right from the start.
Okay, so that's Greece. Now, if we shift our gaze to ancient Egypt around 2000 BCE onwards, we find some very practical concepts of artificial workers. Mm. The Ushabti funerary servants, for example.
Ah, yes, the Ushabti. Small figurines placed in tombs. They were inscribed with spells from the Book of the Dead, and the idea was that these spells would animate them to perform labor for the deceased in the afterlife, everything from farming to carrying burdens. This is a really direct concept of artificial workers created specifically to obey commands, serving a very specific, almost contractual purpose.
So, thousands of years ago, people were already envisioning artificial life not just for wonder, but for practical, efficient labor. That directly mirrors our modern quest for AI-driven automation, doesn't it?
It really does. The function of AI, it seems, is a timeless human need. We've always wanted help, tireless help.
And Egypt had its own real-world illusions, too, often used to augment priestly power, it seems. The talking statue of Amenhotep III, known as Memnon.
Right, the Colossus of Memnon. It was said to make a sharp singing sound at dawn. Now, modern physics explains this. It's likely the sudden heating of broken stone by the morning sun, causing air inside cracks to resonate. But back then, a divine marvel.
And priests reportedly used hidden mechanisms, didn't they, to make statues of gods like Rehharmachis appear to speak, or to make the god Amun statue stretch its arm to choose pharaohs.
Exactly. These weren't true AI, obviously, but they show how early technological ingenuity, however rudimentary, was used to create convincing illusions of animation and intelligence, and crucially, how these illusions could reinforce power structures and belief systems.
That's an intriguing parallel. It makes you wonder how much of the magic was actually mechanical trickery and how much was just the perception and belief of the audience looking on.
A bit like our own black box understanding of some complex AI systems today, perhaps, where the internal workings are so complex they can feel almost magical, even if they're purely algorithmic.
That's a great point. Okay, speaking of other ancient cultures, let's hop over to ancient India from around the 4th to 3rd centuries BCE. They had some equally fascinating tales.
Absolutely. The Susruta Samhita, an ancient Sanskrit text, describes a female android made of wood, apparently a beauty without equal. She was capable of self-movement, serving wine, even making eye contact. The only thing she lacked was speech.
And there's a story about her being used in a clever trick played on a painter.
That's right. It highlights not just the desire for companionship or service, but also the capacity for deception inherent in such realistic creations. If something looks real enough, it can fool you.
And Buddhist legends, they feature automata too.
Yes, quite dramatically. Armies of automata specifically guarding Buddha's relics, featuring killer robots and formidable robot guardians. What's particularly interesting here is the detail that the knowledge of their creation was apparently smuggled from Greek speakers.
Wow, really? That suggests a remarkable cross-cultural exchange of these early technological visions.
Exactly. It indicates these ideas weren't just popping up in isolation. They traveled, influenced each other, and evolved across vast distances. The dream of the automaton was clearly contagious.
It certainly seems so. Moving into the later medieval and Islamic world, we see these themes continue, often with increasing mechanical sophistication, right?
Definitely. Medieval Latin Christendom has its own tales. Golden robot archers, killer robots, armed copper robots guarding tombs and treasures. That function of guarding remains a consistently strong thread, underscoring that deep human need for protection that could be delegated to tireless, unfeeling machines.
And then we see some actual tangible advancements, not just stories, like the Arabic inventor Al-Jazari.
Al-Jazari, yes. He lived from 1136 to 1206 CE. He wasn't just dreaming, he was building incredible things. He constructed a remarkable band of automata that played music, essentially a programmable robot orchestra. He also designed sophisticated wheeled cupbearers and servants.
So, echoing those earlier Greek concepts of automated service, but with significantly more advanced engineering behind it.
Precisely. Showcasing a burgeoning understanding of mechanics, hydraulics, and programmable sequences. He was a true pioneer.
And if we jump forward again to Europe in 1735, we have Jacques de Vaucanson's artificial duck.
Oh, the duck. A marvel of its time. This wasn't a myth or an illusion. It was a complex mechanical creation with thousands of moving parts. It mimicked intricate biological functions, eating, digesting, quacking, even splashing water.
It truly embodied that Enlightenment era desire to replicate life through pure mechanism, didn't it? Pushing the boundaries of what was considered possible without a biological component.
Absolutely. It was a statement about the power of human ingenuity to understand and replicate the natural world piece by piece.
So we've explored this rich tapestry of ancient myths and the earliest proto-machines, all reflecting humanity's deep-seated fascination with artificial life. But what about the underlying philosophical ideas? Where did this enduring drive to understand and create artificial life really come from at a conceptual level?
That's a great question, because the philosophical lineage here is incredibly deep. It arguably stretches back to the very dawn of Western thought. If you connect this to the bigger picture, it maybe starts with ancient materialism. Thinkers like Democritus, one of the early Greek atomists.
The atom guy, right?
Yeah. He believed living things possessed a psyche or soul, but crucially, he thought this soul was made of fire atoms. Now, as archaic as that sounds today, this was one of the first materialist reductionist accounts of life. It suggested that life could potentially be explained purely by the interaction of fundamental particles and forces, rather than by some mysterious, ineffable spirit.
So trying to break life down to its basic material components, even back then.
Exactly. And the core enduring insight from centuries of philosophical thought on this topic might be this. The very definition of life and intelligence is constantly being reshaped by our technology and our imagination. We've always tried to reduce life to its fundamental building blocks, from atomistic fire souls all the way to algorithms blurring the lines between creation and being.
That's a foundational concept right there. Then, much later in the 17th century, we see the rise of modern mechanism, particularly with René Descartes.
Descartes, yes. He famously viewed animals as non-sentient automata, basically complex machines. He thought their behavior could be explained entirely by their internal parts and external forces, much like a clock. He even conceived of an artificial man whose functions would follow as naturally as the movements of a clock, suggesting that maybe human actions, too, might ultimately be mechanically explainable.
That's quite a leap, and Thomas Hobbes took it even further.
He did. Hobbes was an even stauncher materialist. He pushed this mechanism idea further, directly impacting the ideas around artificial life. He considered human reason itself as nothing but reckoning or computation, basically, adding and subtracting concepts. And he famously asked, why may we not say that all automata engines that move themselves by springs and wheels as doth a watch have an artificial life?
Wow, that's a striking parallel to modern definitions of artificial life or a life.
It really is. He was suggesting that if life is fundamentally about self-motion originating from within, then mechanical devices could, in principle, possess it too. He was essentially arguing that life is about self-motion, the mechanics of it, not necessarily tied to a soul or consciousness in the way we might think.
That's a profound thought, connecting gears and springs to the very essence of life. And this philosophical thread continues, doesn't it? The Darwinian Revolution brought another crucial layer.
Absolutely. Charles Darwin's insight was that evolution by natural selection functions at an algorithmic level. What does that mean? Well, It means life isn't just a static thing, it's a dynamic process. A process of information processing, adaptation, and selection, shaping the very mechanisms of life over vast spans of time. It's not just about what life is, but how it functions and changes through a set of underlying rules or processes.
So life is an algorithm, in a sense.
In a very deep sense, yes. And this conceptual shift leads directly to the functionalist turn in the 20th century. Think of John von Neumann's groundbreaking work on self-replicating machines and cellular automata.
Von Neumann, the computer pioneer.
Exactly. He began to abstract the process of life away from its underlying biological medium, flesh and blood, to purely functional organization. He envisioned systems that could copy themselves, not necessarily through biological means, but through a set of instructions and interactions. He focused on the logic of replication rather than the material of replication.
And this idea really culminated with Christopher Langton's Strong a Life thesis, right?
That's right. Langton's thesis boldly suggested that life itself isn't necessarily tied to biology. It's a process that could potentially happen in any medium, even purely digital ones, as long as the right functional organization is present. This is fundamentally functionalist and reductionist. And it directly parallels the strong AI view, which argues that a sufficiently programmed computer is a mind, not just a simulation of one. The implication being that the physical stuff, the substrate, might not be as important as the functional organization and the information processing going on.
Okay, so from these ancient philosophical musings about what constitutes life, we leap directly into the scientific pursuit of intelligence itself, charting its course from pure logic to complex neural networks. It's a journey that really kicks off in the 20th century, largely thanks to one pivotal figure.
You must be talking about Alan Turing.
Exactly. His seminal 1950 paper, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, is often considered the setting sail for AI. It really established the theoretical framework for what we now understand as artificial intelligence. His contributions laid the foundation for so much of what we see today.
Absolutely fundamental. His work is still relevant.
Let's unpack some of his key contributions. First, he introduced the imitation game, which we all know now as the Turing test.
Right. And this wasn't just a theoretical exercise. It fundamentally shifted the debate. It moved away from that tricky, maybe unanswerable philosophical question of can machines have consciousness to a more practical, observable question. Can machines behave intelligently to the point where they're indistinguishable from a human in conversation?
So focusing on performance over internal state, it asserted that electronic computers could learn to think based on their functional aspects.
Precisely. And he didn't stop there. He also made the insightful case that punishment could play a part in the machine learning process. He suggested that AI could learn to make judgments through reward and punishment signals, even without having actual emotions.
Which sounds a lot like modern reinforcement learning.
It deeply foreshadowed it, decades ahead of its time, the idea that algorithms learn optimal behaviors through trial and error, driven by positive and negative feedback.
He even touched on the idea that intelligent systems might behave unpredictably, didn't he? Not randomly, but perhaps deviating slightly from rigid logic to produce novel, sometimes surprising, intelligent outputs. His concept of a learning machine was a direct precursor to modern machine learning.
And that initial, almost innocent-sounding question he posed, where's the best place to begin research? Chess or hardware? That really initiated that fundamental tug-of-war in early AI, didn't it? Between symbolic logic, the rules of the game, like chess, and the physical implementation, the hardware.
It certainly did. And from Turing's visionary framework, two dominant AI paradigms emerged and evolved, often kind of battling it out. The first was symbolism, which really reigned supreme from the 1950s through maybe the 1990s.
Right. Symbolic AI, sometimes called GOAK AI, good old-fashioned AI. This approach focused on building AI that could think through problems using clear rules and pre-programmed information. Think of it like a meticulous logician or following a strict set of instructions. It prioritized explicit knowledge encoding and logical reasoning.
This sounds very much like what people initially imagined computers would do, right? Just precisely follow logical steps. And it saw progress through things like automatic theorem proving ATP.
Which was great for solving complex mathematical logic issues.
And expert systems, ES, those were a big deal for a while.
They were. Expert systems like Dendril for chemical inference or MICIN for medical diagnosis performed incredibly well in very specific, tightly closed domains. They could diagnose certain illnesses or identify chemical structures with impressive accuracy. But they struggled immensely when faced with open real-world problems. things that required common sense or intuitive understanding.
Why was that? What was the limitation?
Well, the challenge was that their problem domain was typically closed and on purpose, meaning basically all the rules and possible outcomes had to be explicitly defined beforehand. This made it incredible. Pretty much. Despite this limitation, symbolism also gave rise to crucial concepts in knowledge representation, or KR. Things like semantic networks, which map relationships between ideas, frames for organizing knowledge about typical situations, and conceptual graphs. This even led to the CYC project back in 1981, essentially the first large-scale knowledge graph, a hugely ambitious attempt to build a massive, machine-readable encyclopedia of common sense, trying to bridge that exact gap.
So the core insight of symbolism was that AI could excel at explicit, rule-based reasoning, but it fundamentally struggled with the messy, intuitive, often unstated rules of common sense that we humans navigate constantly.
That's a good way to put it. And we still see echoes of that today, right? Google's knowledge graph, which we all interact with daily when you search for a famous person or a place and get that info box, that was released in 2015 and built directly upon this symbolic foundation. It organizes vast amounts of explicit knowledge about entities and their relationships. It showed the enduring power of organizing explicit knowledge, even if that grand vision of universal common sense remained elusive for decades.
Okay, so symbolism was one path. What was the other major paradigm?
In contrast to symbolism, we have connectionism. This paradigm spans from the 1940s, arguably even earlier conceptually, right up to the present day. And this approach was originally motivated much more by biology. The goal was to imitate the human brain's biological neural networks with artificial neural networks, or ANNs.
So a direct inspiration from the brain itself. How did that develop initially?
Early developments included the McCulloch-Pitts model back in 1943, which was a very simple mathematical model trying to represent how biological neurons might fire, sort of an on-off switch logic. And then Frank Rosenblatt's perceptron in 1957, a simple type of ANN capable of learning to classify basic patterns. These were foundational attempts to mathematically model how neurons might work together.
But it wasn't smooth sailing, was it? There was the AI winter.
No, definitely not smooth sailing. This early promise ran into trouble, leading to what's often called the first AI winter. This came largely after Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert's very critical book, Perceptrons, in 1969. They famously pointed out the perceptron's fundamental limitations, for instance, its inability to solve seemingly simple nonlinear problems like the XOR problem, figuring out if two inputs are different. This critique led to a significant loss of funding and interest for ANN research for nearly a decade.
Wow, one book had that much impact.
It did, combined with some maybe over-optimistic promises early on. But like a phoenix, connectionism saw a powerful revival in the 1980s.
Who brought it back?
A few things converged. A crucial new algorithm called backpropagation, or BP, which was actually developed back in 1974 by Paul Werbos, finally gained traction. It added a hidden layer to neural networks, allowing them to learn far more complex nonlinear patterns, including solving that pesky XOR problem, though it was initially overlooked for years.
So the solution was there, just not recognized.
Pretty much. The real unexpected stimulus, though, came from physicist John Hopfield in the early 80s. His Hopfield networks, inspired by spin systems and physics, totally different field, not only resolved the XOR problem, but also proved useful in optimization problems. This sparked a huge wave of new ANN research and brought an interdisciplinary energy back to the field.
And then the publication of the Parallel Distributed Processing, PDP volumes, in 1986 further solidified this resurgence, didn't it? Providing a comprehensive framework for these connectionist models.
Exactly. It was a landmark publication. And what's fascinating here is how the field of AI, after absorbing much from other disciplines like psychology and physics, began to influence them in turn. It created this synergistic exchange of ideas that really propelled things forward.
And then came what some call the Copernican Revolution for connectionism, deep learning, starting around 2006 and continuing today.
Yes, deep learning. This was largely driven by two key factors: the explosion of the internet, providing massive amounts of data, the fuel these algorithms need, and significant increases in computing power, especially GPUs. Jeffrey Hinton's work in 2006 was absolutely key. He figured out ways to effectively train these much deeper networks, often involving converting high-dimensional data into lower-dimensional codes and pioneering techniques like pre-training layers. This allowed machines to actively learn intricate features and hierarchies from vast data sets without needing humans to manually label everything. That was the game changer.
So the core insight of connectionism, inspired by the brain, was revealing the immense power of learning directly from data patterns, even without explicit rules. This led directly to the current AI boom we're experiencing.
Absolutely. Which brings us to modern ANNs, the backbone of today's AI systems. We now have all sorts of specialized architectures, convolutional neural networks, CNNs, which excel at machine vision, identifying objects and images, powering self-driving cars to see. Then there are recurrent neural networks, RNNs, designed for sequential data like language. They help us understand speech and text, power translation tools, things like that. And graph neural networks, GNNs, which are really good at understanding relationships between entities. Think social networks, molecular structures, or even improving those knowledge graphs we talked about earlier.
And looking even further ahead.
Well, people are even designing quantum neural networks, QNNs, for quantum computers, promising potentially even greater computational power for certain types of problems, though that's still very early days. All of these aim at a macroscopic level to simulate aspects of brain intelligence and learn complex representations directly from data.
It's incredible to see how far we've come from those early, simple neuron models to these incredibly sophisticated self-learning systems. But all this progress naturally leads us back to those deeper philosophical questions, doesn't it? Bridging mind and machine, trying to understand the core distinctions. As we build more intelligent systems, we're forced to ask ourselves again, what exactly is intelligence?
What's fascinating here is that the initial design of any AI program often stems from some kind of theoretical proposition, not just pure computation. This inevitably pushes us back into philosophical thinking, compelling us to ask, what is intelligence really? And how do we even begin to achieve it artificially? Is mimicking enough?
One underlying premise of symbolism, for instance, was that intelligent activity requires a physical symbol system. Meaning, intelligence is fundamentally about manipulating symbols according to rules like language or mathematics. And the argument went, if man is characterized by a physical symbol system, then human intelligence itself might be reducible to this same kind of symbolic processing.
Which is a very specific, maybe limited view of intelligence, a very reductionist view, trying to fit the complexity of human thought into a neat logical framework.
And this raises an important question, one that philosopher Hubert Dreyfus famously critiqued for decades.
Right. Dreyfus argued forcefully that human brains might process information fundamentally differently than digital computers. He emphasized embodied experience, intuition, context, common sense, all the things that symbolic AI really struggled with. He argued that much of our intelligence isn't based on explicit rules, but on tacit know-how. Interestingly, while he was initially highly critical of symbolic AI, he later showed more measured expectations for ANNs, acknowledging that perhaps connectionism offered a more promising path, even if our early models were still too simplistic to fully reflect biological reality.
And then there's Hilary Putnam's functionalism, his famous thought experiments like the brain in a vat or twin earth.
Ah, yes, those classic philosophical puzzles. They were designed to challenge the idea that true understanding only comes from what's inside our heads, that private internal feeling of knowing something, what philosophers call intentionality or qualia. Instead, Putnam argued, understanding might be more about how we use information and connect it to the real world, how it functions in context and produces appropriate behavior. So AI's progress with things like knowledge graphs and the complex logical structures emerging in artificial neural systems, systems that process and relate information effectively, actually supports Putnam's functionalist argument in a way. It suggests understanding isn't solely an interior subjective conception, but also crucially about its functional role.
This leads us directly to perhaps the most fundamental question. Is there an unbridgeable chasm between biological intelligence, BI, and artificial intelligence, AI?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Or maybe trillion-dollar now.
Historically, we've always used the most advanced technology of the time as a metaphor for the human brain. Descartes compared it to a hydraulic press, Freud to a steam engine.
And today, we constantly talk about the brain as a computer or a neural network.
Exactly. This highlights that AI, even now, is fundamentally a mimic of BI biological intelligence, not a direct replica. It might appear to perform similar functions, sometimes even better in specific tasks, but its underlying nature, its origins, its goals, if you will, are profoundly different.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, the learning process itself is profoundly different. While AI, like DeepMind's AlphaStar mastering incredibly complex video games like StarCraft II, can certainly master tasks that seem incredibly intelligent. its learning doesn't mirror human learning. Not really. Think about Immanuel Kant's idea of synthetic a priori judgments in biological brains. He was describing innate mental structures. For example, a baby doesn't need to be explicitly taught basic concepts like time, space, cause and effect, or a primal sense of danger avoidance.
They're kind of built in.
Exactly. These are built-in mental structures, ingrained by millions of years of biological evolution, a kind of genetically derived instinctual knowledge base that allows us to make sense of the world from the get-go.
So these are hardwired for us, products of deep evolutionary history. How does that compare to AI?
Well, in contrast, an AI's knowledge representation is fundamentally empirical, at least currently. It's trained from massive data sets, and its internal knowledge consists of statistical patterns represented by adjusted weights in its network derived algorithmically. It doesn't evolve biologically over generations, nor does it inherently possess these broad, innate, multi-domain common sense structures right out of the box. An AI program currently cannot spontaneously learn truly diverse skills or knowledge far beyond its specific training data and objectives. It's not a comprehensive program for all behavior and survival in the same way biological intelligence is.
Which brings us to a really provocative idea mentioned in the sources, the metaprogram concept.
Yes. The idea here is that biological intelligence acts as a kind of metaprogram for all biological behavior and mental processes. It originates from the historical process of survival and reproduction over millions of years. It's fundamentally geared towards keeping the organism alive, adapting, and reproducing. That's its ultimate purpose, honed by evolution. An AI program, on the other hand, is written by humans for specific tasks. Play Go, translate languages, identify cats. It lacks this unique, deep nature or evolutionary imperative. This suggests a fundamental, perhaps unbridgeable, intelligence distinction between AI and BI.
Unless,
as the source provocatively suggests, there's some kind of subversive cultural and ideological revolution to abolish concepts like life itself, essentially, redefining what it means to be alive or intelligent to the point where the distinction collapses.
That's a truly philosophical leap, but it helps explain why even sophisticated connectionist AI still struggles in truly open environments, like trying to be a nuanced stock market trader dealing with unpredictable human psychology or navigating the infinite complexities of human relationships.
Exactly. It performs exceptionally well in environments with clear rules and goals, like mastering Go or solving complex mathematical problems. But the real world is far more unpredictable, ambiguous, and requires constant flexible adaptation across domains. The micro-level complexities of biological brains, all those tiny dynamic changes happening between neurons, how they connect and adapt in real time, things like synaptic remodeling, neuromodulation, these are incredibly intricate electrochemical processes that we currently can't fully replicate in artificial neural networks at the larger functional level. We simulate the network, but not necessarily the underlying biological richness.
Which is why neurosymbolic AI is emerging as such a critical and exciting area of research now.
Precisely. It's an attempt to get the best of both worlds. To combine the expressiveness and logical structures of symbolic systems, their ability for explicit reasoning and explanation, with the adaptability and powerful empirical learning capabilities of connectionism derived from massive data patterns. It's seen as a pioneering development trying to bridge that gap between pattern recognition and structured reasoning.
Are there concrete examples of this?
Yes. For instance, the source mentions P. Blazek and M. Lin's Essence Neural Networks, or ENNs. This is a model aiming for deep neural networks that are more explainable, incorporate symbolic reasoning, and are perhaps more neurobiologically reflective. Apparently, they've shown promising cognitive capabilities and have even outperformed existing deep neural networks on certain reasoning tasks, partly because their decisions can be traced more transparently.
So moving beyond the black box.
That's the goal. Now, the source acknowledges that even models like ENNs are still insufficient for artificial general intelligence, or AGI, that hypothetical AI capable of human-level intelligence across multiple domains, but they represent a good start. Mm-hmm. And intriguingly, this research suggests a feedback loop. By trying to build AI that reasons more like humans, and by understanding how these AI cognitive processes work, we might in turn gain new insights into human cognition itself. The machine could end up teaching us about ourselves.
Now, this is where our deep dive takes a truly fascinating turn. How AI isn't just mimicking ancient dreams or philosophical concepts, but is actively becoming a new lens through which we understand the past. And perhaps paradoxically developing its own form of mysticism in the present.
Yes, this is a really exciting intersection. What's fascinating here is how AI is genuinely revolutionizing archaeology. It's allowing us to uncover hidden histories in ways that were previously completely impossible. For example, AI is transforming site discovery and mapping. It can scan vast data sets, satellite imagery, LiDAR scans, aerial photos identify overlooked sites, and lead to discoveries even in remote, difficult to access areas that human eyes might just scan over.
That's incredible. Can you give an example?
Sure. A recent study in Mesopotamia used deep learning models trained on satellite data. They were able to detect potential archaeological sites with about 80% accuracy, potentially revealing lost settlements or structures on an unprecedented scale. And there's the Cultural Landscape Scanner, project a collaboration between the Italian Institute of Technology and the European Space Agency. They're using machine learning on satellite images to detect really subtle, almost invisible signs of ancient human activity, things like faint earthworks or soil discolorations that humans might easily miss.
And this isn't just about finding sites, it helps protect them too.
Exactly. This kind of analysis crucially aids in cultural heritage preservation. It can help identify sites under threat from development, agriculture, or even looting, providing an early warning system for heritage managers.
And technologies like LiDAR combined with AI.
Right. LiDAR uses pulsed laser light to map terrain with incredible detail, even through dense vegetation. When you combine that data with AI analysis, it's revealing entire hidden structures beneath jungle canopies, like sprawling Mayan cities in Central America that were completely obscured before. There's also the Iamina Project, endangered archaeology in the Middle East and North Africa. They're using remote sensing methods combined with AI to rapidly document threatened sites across 20 countries. AI allows this large-scale, systematic documentation to happen far more quickly and thoroughly than traditional ground surveys ever could.
So discovery and documentation are being transformed. What about analyzing the things they find? Artifacts, human remains?
AI is making huge inroads there, too. It enables more accurate and rapid classification of artifacts. Think about pottery recognition tools like ArchAid. Use AI to help archaeologists identify and categorize thousands of pottery fragments much faster than manual sorting. It can also build predictive models for where certain types of artifacts are likely to be found. And for genomic research, it's a game changer. AI algorithms process vast amounts of ancient DNA data extracted from skeletal remains. This reveals incredible details about past populations, migration patterns, family relationships, health information, even ancient diets and diseases by analyzing the microbiomes preserved in teeth or bones. We're literally piecing together the lives of people who lived thousands of years ago at a genetic level.
Wow. And what about texts? Ancient languages?
AI is proving crucial there as well. Take the Babylonian Engine Project. They're developing neural machine translation models specifically designed to translate ancient Akkadian texts written in cuneiform script directly into English. The accuracy is getting impressively high, and it's far faster and more consistent than relying solely on human experts for every single tablet.
So it's not replacing experts, but augmenting them.
Yeah.
Allowing them to tackle vast archives.
Precisely. It significantly reduces the incredibly time-consuming manual work for historians and epigraphers, opening up vast archives of texts that were previously just too overwhelming to analyze comprehensively. Beyond translation, AI also helps create detailed 3D models of artifacts and sites, improves virtual and augmented reality experiences for exploring ancient places virtually, helps predict the degradation of fragile sites, and supports massive digital archiving efforts. It's making our past more accessible, more understandable, and better preserved.
Okay, so AI is finding sites, analyzing artifacts, reading texts. But can it help archaeologists generate entirely new ideas, new interpretations they might not have thought of?
That's where it gets really exciting, moving beyond just efficiency to actual insight generation. This is where tools like iArch come in, focusing on explainable AI or XAI for archaeology.
Explainable AI.
Yeah, the idea is AI that doesn't just give you an answer, but can also provide some insight into why it reached that conclusion. The iArch tool, for instance, enables archaeologists, even those without programming skills, to perform XAI data analytics. Its purpose is twofold. Validate existing hypotheses using data, but also, crucially, to generate novel insights and hypotheses from numerical and categorical data, potentially overcoming human biases in interpretation.
Okay, let's unpack this with that real-world example you mentioned, the Xiongnu Cemetery in the Mongolian steppes, dating from around 100 BC to 100 AD.
Right. So the data set here involved 47 buried individuals. They had detailed information on grave architecture, things like depth, whether they had a double coffin, plus lists of cultural items found with them, like furniture, food offerings, animal sacrifices. And importantly, thanks to ancient DNA analysis, they knew the genealogical relationships for 18 of these people, spanning five generations, a really rich data set.
So how did they use IARC first to validate existing hypotheses?
Okay, for hypothesis one, which was about genealogical affiliation, they tried to use the AI to predict family membership with someone in family, part of the known elite lineage, or outside family. They fed the model cultural features like grave volume, depth, wealth index based on grave goods, presence of Chinese imports, etc. An advanced AI model, XGBoost, achieved about 70% accuracy in predicting this.
Which confirms there's a link between those cultural markers and kinship, right?
Exactly. But what's truly powerful here is that the explainable AI part using a technique called SHAP could show them why the AI made those predictions. It highlighted that grave volume, depth, and being buried in two coffins were the top features pointing towards in-family status. Age over 30 also contributed positively. Things like gender were more neutral. This directly validated the archaeologists' long-held hypotheses about the role of kinship in Xiong Nu burial practices, confirming their expert knowledge with data-driven insights. It showed the AI was picking up on the signals the experts expected.
Okay, what about hypothesis two, predicting wealth?
For that, they tried predicting the wealth index categorized as poor, medium, or rich using those same cultural features. Here, the XGBoost model achieved a striking 100% accuracy.
100%, wow.
Yeah, it indicates that the social differences, as reflected in the cultural items buried with the deceased, were so pronounced that the model could easily detect and categorize them with perfect accuracy. It strongly confirmed significant social stratification.
Did that lead to any new interpretations?
It did. Because the model was so accurate, it gave them confidence to look closer at the details. It suggested that people outside the known influential genealogy could still be rich, perhaps due to their own high social status, maybe military achievements, or even potentially having Chinese ancestry, given the presence of valuable Chinese imports in some non-lineage graves. This is an idea not previously prominent in the historical understanding that kinship might grant access to the elite cemetery. But wealth and status determination within it could be more flexible, perhaps even favoring social standing or foreign connections in some cases. That's a nuance uncovered partly thanks to the AI's clear classification.
Okay, so validating existing ideas and refining them. But you said it could generate entirely new hypotheses too. How does that work?
This is arguably the most exciting application using AI to potentially overcome our inherent human biases and pattern recognition and interpretation. In one experiment described in the source, they intentionally removed the genetic data, forcing the AI to cluster the individuals based purely on the archaeological features found in their graves. Using explainable clustering techniques, combining methods like k-means clustering with random forests and SHA analysis to understand the resulting groups, the AI identified five optimal, distinct clusters of individuals, each with unique characteristics.
And what did these AI-generated clusters reveal?
Some truly unexpected groupings and insights emerged. For instance, the AI grouped three poor women who genetically belonged to the rich, influential genealogy together with the absolute poorest individuals in the cemetery. This immediately raised new questions. Were strict patrilinear or patrilocal rules forcing women out of their birth lineage's status? Or were these individuals perhaps from a perceived bad lineage within the main family? Or had they suffered an unexpected fall in status?
So the AI highlighted anomalies that demanded new explanations.
Precisely. One of these women, despite living during the empire's peak economic period, was classified as poor by the AI based on her grave goods. The researchers then asked, was she considered poor because she simply shouldn't have been buried there in the elite grounds despite her lineage? The other two, a mother and daughter also from the influential lineage, were grouped with the poorest but were buried during the empire's later collapse. So was their poverty due to the societal collapse affecting even elites, or was it indeed a reflection of a perceived bad lineage getting less investment even in death? The AI grouping forced these new specific questions.
Any other surprising clusters?
Yes, another fascinating case involved a couple who were known genetically to be from a bad lineage. They had their skulls removed post-mortem and were buried in an extreme northern position in the cemetery. The AI grouped them distinctly. This suggested entirely different access rules to the cemetery might have applied to them, or perhaps specific symbolic treatment related to their lineage and the skull removal, implying complex social dynamics not easily captured by simple in or out categories. And one more. A man, also from a bad lineage, whose wife was identified as being rich, likely due to Chinese ancestry based on her grave goods. The AI grouped him in a way that suggested wealth and power could potentially be gained through marriage, perhaps allowing him recognition and burial in the elite cemetery where his own lineage might not have granted it.
These are genuinely novel interpretations arising directly from the AI's pattern finding, aren't they?
Absolutely. They are interpretations that the AI unearthed by finding patterns across many variables simultaneously, offering completely new narratives and research questions for the archaeologists to explore. It demonstrates how AI can save significant time for archaeologists, allowing them to explore vast, complex datasets more effectively. But more importantly, it shows how AI can help experts generate novel, unexpected interpretations that might have been overlooked by traditional human-led analysis alone. It's a powerful example of AI actively helping us rewrite and refine our understanding of the past, revealing truths that were perhaps hidden in the complexity of the data.
It's astonishing how these tools can uncover things we might never have considered. But as powerful and revolutionary as these new technologies are, the sources also suggest they come with their own set of modern myths and uncertainties. It's almost like we're entering a new era of technology mysticism.
That's a really interesting framing from the source material, yeah. The idea that AI itself is becoming an object of awe and apprehension, much like incomprehensible natural phenomena, thunder, floods, eclipses were to our ancestors. We're essentially facing the complexities and power of AI today in a way not dissimilar to how ancient peoples faced phenomena they couldn't fully explain or control.
That's precisely it. We're facing AI today much like our ancestors faced the thunder, the tides, or the changing seasons, these powerful forces that were difficult to fully grasp. And what's fascinating here is the historical interplay discussed between mythos, narrative explanations for the inexplicable, and logos rationality and logical understanding.
Right. The Enlightenment, with its strong emphasis on reason, truly hoped to banish myths through logical understanding and scientific inquiry. But instead, the source argues rationality itself can, somewhat ironically, create new myths. Like the myth of control and mastery over nature through technology, or even myth of mythlessness, this modern pretense that our society is somehow completely rational and immune to powerful, non-rational narratives.
So we're not just dealing with simple misunderstandings about AI, though those certainly exist. The source suggests there are actually two distinct levels of AI myth operating today.
Exactly. The first level consists of potentially resolvable misunderstandings. This is often fueled by the hype around AI, you know, the breathless media coverage, the sometimes unrealistic predictions. We see this captured in things like the Gartner hype cycle for emerging technologies. This kind of hype can largely be demystified through a clearer, rational understanding of AI's actual current capabilities versus the often exaggerated claims.
Okay, that's the hype level, but then there's the second, deeper level.
Yes, and this is perhaps more culturally significant. These are more profound, sometimes non-rational narratives shaped by our collective fears and hopes about AI. This includes the pervasive myth of the thinking machine, the cultural belief, often fueled by science fiction, that AI can or soon will perfectly simulate all aspects of human cognitive abilities, including consciousness, emotions, empathy. It's reinforced by analogies and these grand future visions.
And alongside the hope, there's the fear. The enduring Frankenstein syndrome.
Yes. The primal fear of our creation turning against us. The fear of AI becoming super intelligent, potentially malevolent, and ultimately controlling or destroying humans. What's fascinating, as the source points out, is that this powerful, often cinematic fear can sometimes distract us from far more realistic and immediate problems.
Such as?
Such as artificial stupidity. That's the idea that AI systems, despite their power, can actually thwart human goals in unexpected, often subtle, and difficult to trace ways. This could be due to biases baked into their training data, errors in their complex code, unexpected interactions between systems, or simply being applied inappropriately. The risk might not be malice, but incompetence or unforeseen consequences at scale.
That raises an important question. Why do AI's limitations, its very real flaws and unknowns, actually seem to reinforce this mysticism around it rather than diminishing it?
It's a bit paradoxical, isn't it? Firstly, AI's inherent bias is a major factor. We need to remember it doesn't operate on pure objective truth. It operates on data collected for specific purposes, often by individuals or organizations with their own interests and values. So AI inevitably reflects the biases, limitations, and even prejudices present in its training data and its creators' choices. It lacks true objectivity. It's not a neutral oracle.
Right. Garbage in, garbage out, potentially amplified.
Exactly, or bias in, bias out. Then there's the pervasive black box phenomenon, which is becoming even more pronounced with modern generative AI. Models like large language models, LLMs, are so incredibly complex with billions or even trillions of parameters interacting in nonlinear ways that their internal workings are often not fully understood, even by the people who built them.
We know they work, but not exactly how they arrive at specific answers.
In many cases, yes. This leads to what's been called a speculative behavior of the overall system we can observe its outputs, but tracing the precise reasoning path is incredibly difficult. This inherent lack of transparency naturally reduces trust and can make the AI seem almost magical or inscrutable. Even explainable AI, XAI, which tries to address this, is sometimes wryly described as a black box explaining another black box, highlighting the ongoing challenge of achieving genuine, deep transparency.
And if we connect this lack of transparency and full understanding to the bigger picture, the source argues it fuels new grand narratives like transhumanism and the quest for artificial superintelligence, ASI.
Precisely. Transhumanism, for example, often views the human body itself as a kind of machine to be optimized, upgraded, and eventually overcome. It holds out the promise of radical life extension, enhanced abilities, and ultimately, perhaps, immortality through methods like mind uploading into digital forms. The source suggests that this can sometimes resemble a kind of self-redemption belief, a quest for technological salvation, feeling more akin to a quasi-religious movement with its own prophet. It does. And the promise that the singularity is near echoes ancient eschatological beliefs' predictions of a world-transforming event. It fosters anticipation, excitement, and sometimes even fanaticism, despite repeated missed deadlines for its arrival. It functions very much like a modern-day prophecy, complete with its own believers, detractors, and ongoing debates about its inevitability.
So given all this, the power, the potential, the pitfalls, the myths, what does this all mean for you, our listener, trying to make sense of AI today?
Well, the source strongly suggests that education is the crucial key. Not just superficial awareness, but real, critical education is needed to demystify AI and navigate this new landscape effectively. This requires developing knowledge of how these complex systems, especially generative AI, actually operate their strengths, weaknesses, and inherent limitations. It means learning how to deal with the inherent uncertainty in their outputs, recognizing that they don't know things in the human sense, and perhaps most importantly, it requires the active application of critical thinking. We need to constantly question AI's grand promises, probe the underlying interests driving its development and deployment, and evaluate its outputs skeptically.
It sounds like a call back to Enlightenment values almost.
In a way, yes. The source explicitly echoes Kant's famous imperative, sapere aud, have the courage to use your own understanding. It's a call for intellectual autonomy and critical engagement in an age of incredibly powerful yet often opaque technology. We can't afford to be passive consumers. We need to be active, informed participants.
And that's where we leave our deep dive for today. What we've unpacked is truly a testament, I think, to the enduring human spirit of innovation and imagination. From the mythical automatons of ancient Greece and Egypt, those artificial servants and guardians, to the sophisticated AI systems of today, humanity has long dreamed of artificial life. And often, as we saw, for very similar practical purposes that mirror our modern AI applications. We've seen how modern AI paradigms, especially with advances in areas like deep learning and neurosymbolic AI, are pushing the boundaries of what's possible. They're even helping us unearth new, unexpected truths about our own past through fields like archaeology, literally helping us rewrite history in some cases.
It's clear that technology isn't just about what's possible, but also very much about what we imagine. And our imagination, it turns out, has been remarkably consistent on this theme across millennia. The forms change, but the core desires for help, for protection, for understanding, maybe even for companion seem timeless. Mm-hmm. Yet as powerful as these new tools are, they undeniably come with their own set of modern myths, biases, and uncertainties. These echo the awe and sometimes the apprehension our ancestors felt towards the powerful unknown forces in their world. The challenge, as always, is to apply our own understanding, our own wisdom, to the powerful tools we create.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? It means that as we continue this journey with AI, the real deep dive isn't just into the technology itself, the algorithms, the data, the hardware. It's also a deep dive into our own understanding, our critical thinking skills, and our collective willingness to actively shape a future. A future where these ancient dreams and modern marvels serve humanity with purpose and clarity, rather than becoming new sources of mystification or unintended consequences. The ongoing conversation about AI is, at its heart, a conversation about ourselves, our values, and the kind of future we want to build.